All right, Channel 9 Live, Visual Studio 2012 launch. We're with Mads Torgersen.
Hello.
How you doing, man?
I am great.
Excellent. So Mads, you're a C-sharp guy, a VB.NET guy, F-sharp guy, but mainly you're working on the C-sharp spec.
Yep.
So with this release, and again, congratulations for shipping.
Thank you.
Async await is a huge feature for you guys.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about that for people out there.
Right. So I think Jason nicely pitched it from a high level in here just a few minutes ago. We're essentially seeing two trends in development right now that are kind of working against each other. Mm. One is that we have more and more latency because everything, like everybody says connected and backend and data, and that's, you know, so there's a lot of chatter on the wire, and that means more stuff to wait for in your client applications, for instance. Okay? So longer delays coupled with a higher demand for responsiveness of your UI, of your apps. We have touch devices now, so if they don't like react immediately and do what you ask them to, you know, it feels sluggish. And so you kind of have things go slower and you have an increased requirement for them to go faster.
Yes.
And you know, that's a conundrum, and it's kind of known, it's been known for a while, what's the medicine for that? You have to go async, you have to code asynchronously. Mm-hmm. And that's all fine, except coding asynchronously using traditional means means changing from a normal structure of your code to doing everything via callbacks. Mm. So instead of calling something, waiting for it to complete, that's, it's all that waiting we want to avoid. So what you do instead is you call something and you tell it, and when you're done, do this. So you give it a callback and say, do this when you're done. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that means you have to structure your code differently. And as it turns out, in a very suboptimal way. You know, your code turns into spaghetti, it becomes very error-prone, very hard to read. Somebody else goes in, like Brian was just talking about, and parachuting into some code that's somebody else's. You know, it's really, really hard to figure out what's going on if you're coding with callbacks. So we wanted to improve that experience and just make your expressiveness in asynchronous situations be awesome.
Yes.
And that's what async is about.
Great.
So it's we've improved our libraries in .NET and the new Windows runtime libraries and so on to be very have a very advanced modern view of asynchrony and expose that, and then we improved the language to consume that in a way that you almost don't feel you're doing asynchronous programming.
Absolutely. So it feels sequential. In fact, it's not.
Right. It is sequential, but it feels synchronous.
Got it.
You can write as if it was synchronous and hardly notice a difference. Then if you want to exploit the asynchrony, like doing several things at once, you can easily switch in and do that and get advanced. But the core basic description of the sequence of your code remains the same as if you had written it synchronously. Just
Excellent.
A few keywords sort of dropped in there and you're good to go.
Async and await. So what does async actually do?
So
let's talk about those keywords.
Oh, you want to get really technical here.
Yeah, let's do it, man. You wrote the spec for that, man.
I guess I did. And
we have questions coming in, by the way.
Okay.
Al, I see you, Al. And I've been the one that's been censoring you, by the way, because Jason Zander cannot answer that question since DevDiv and Jason, those guys have nothing to do with that. But we'll ask Tim. Anyway, back to asking him a question now about real briefly, because we do want to get to other people's questions as
yes.
well. But what is async and what is await? Tell me what they do.
Right. So async is essentially something you put in a method in C# or Visual Basic, since they both do the same things nowadays.
We'll talk about that.
And that's telling it to telling it to be an asynchronous method.
Okay.
What that means is that instead of doing things in time and then completing and returning to the caller, when you call an asynchronous method, it returns immediately. Mm. So it kicks something off and then returns to the caller saying, okay, I'm done kicking it off. And by the way, here's a token, here's a ticket to the result once it becomes available. We call that a task.
Mm.
Okay, so that's what an async method is. And await is something you can say inside of an async method to consume other tasks. So I have something here that represents the act of going over the wire and fetching some data, okay? Mm. I have a task representing that. This is the tasks, it's an object that represents an activity. Mm. And then await says, don't do anything else here in this async method until that result comes back. Okay, in other words, sign up a callback on that thing that will execute the rest of my method once it's time, once I have that result.
Excellent. Excellent. All right, Al, we're going to ask your question now, man. Here's one for Harry. Harry, Harry's not up here. Come on, guys. So, Matt, sticking with you, of course, I want to touch on the fact that you mentioned this. VB.NET and C# are co-evolving. Yes. Can you tell me a little bit more about co-evolution?
Right. I mean, we've talked about it for a couple of years now. It's co-evolution is a fancy name for a strategy we embarked on, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years ago, maybe. Mm. We were trying to, for the first while C# and Visual Basic were both on .NET, we were sort of trying to give them each their own identity and maybe serve different audiences and so on. And what we saw was that the only thing we created with that very sort of independent development was huge feature envy kind of situation. Everybody wanted the features that were in the other language as well. Mm. And like, why can't we have that? Mm-hmm. And it kind of dawned on us that these two audiences aren't that different in what they do and what expressive power they need. They're actually often the same people doing C# some of the time and VB some of the time. And what they, you know, it's more of a historical accident or preference that they're in one language or the other. And we should treat them more the same. And so we actually started both organizationally merging the teams. Mm-hmm. So I'm on the VB language design team. And the VB guy, Lucian Wyszyk, who's me for VB, is on the C# design team and so on. And so we're very closely collaborating and deliberately putting every significant new feature into both languages and also catching the languages up to each other with already existing features. So as an example,
yes.
Visual Basic, on top of all these cool new features, Visual Basic now comes out with iterators, which is a feature that's been in C# since C# 2.0. Again, just making the languages closer to parity.
Absolutely. Now, of course, one of the features that VB had was sort of this dynamic capability and late binding and stuff like that. You added that to C# with a dynamic keyword. What else has come from VB to C#? So that direction.
I think that was the main one.
That's the main one.
There are a couple of other things like, well, actually, I think optional arguments is a pretty big one as well. And being able to named an optional arguments is a pretty big one that is standard for VB folks. And we sort of took the high road we felt in C# in the old days, like thou shalt not do this kind of thing. If you want to differentiate, have multiple overloads.
Sure. So we're live, so remember to ask questions. You have Mads Torgerson, who's on the C# language design team, the VB language design team, the Roslyn design team, and I want to ask you about Roslyn. But so come on, Al, ask a question that's related to the person
Please,
on stage.
Please, get some questions in here.
All right. So. Yep. Roslyn, we've talked about it for a while now.
Yes.
I mean, I last interviewed, I can't remember his name, unfortunately, I'm sorry, but a developer on the team, I interviewed him in Amsterdam. Talk to me about the status of Roslyn today.
Roslyn, so first of all, for people who don't know what Roslyn is,
Roslyn
is a code name. It's a cute little mining town out on the other side of the Cascade Mountains from here.
Interesting.
It is the code name for our new compilers for C# and VB. And not just the compilers in the traditional sense of being things that take your source code and translate them into running code, mm-hmm. but being APIs that open up for all the incredibly advanced and useful knowledge that they have about what your code means.
Okay,
so they'll expose syntax trees and semantic analysis of all kinds of binding information, data flow information, all that kind of stuff. They'll expose as APIs that you can target at source code and use to build things on.
Sure.
Okay. So the things you think of building, well, first of all, we're building our entire IDE on top of this public API now. So there's nothing hidden, nothing like no sort of backdoor that we're reaching in when we do IntelliSense or something like that. It's all through a public API that everybody could do the same.
Interesting.
And so people can go and build third-party plugins that do some little bit of analysis, whether it's just checking that you're following your company's code guidance,
sure.
or whether it's more advanced static analysis, other kinds of stuff, more interactive features, suggesting new refactorings that you wrote yourself, and so on. All that kind of stuff becomes incredibly easy to write on top of Roslyn compared to what you have to do now, which is essentially do your best at parsing the C# or VB code yourself and make the best of it.
This is true.
You get a whole different barrier to entry, which we hope will give a lively ecosystem of goodies that will eventually benefit everyone, right? So maybe just a tenth of a percent of all C# developers will actually build on Rustling themselves. But if the stuff they build gets out there, then all these incredible little, maybe domain-specific things that we could never build will be out there and incredibly useful to a vast audience.
Absolutely. And of course, this, you know, it's important. This goes back to, at least this is somewhat part of the project, is the fact that you guys are taking your compiler, which today is written in C and C++, and you're writing it in the language of that it's compiling, so
yes.
VB.NET or C#.
Exactly.
How's that experience going for you?
It's great. We're dogfooding for the first time, man.
Right on.
It's so embarrassing. You know, it's the first compiler 101, thou shalt self-host, right? We have never been doing that. Finally, we're doing that. So it's so liberating. We immediately see the effects of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. We have a strong impetus to get the last language features implemented so we can use them to build the compiler with.
Sure.
It just turns out that C# and VB are incredibly nice languages to build compilers in as well.
Excellent.
You should never, like, design a programming language for building compilers, but it's been a nice affirmation that they were good at this more analytic stuff as well.
Great. And what is it about, you know, C# that makes it that? So what is it about these two languages that make what you said true?
I think it's mostly that the standard productivity things turn out to be true also for a relatively low-level thing like a compiler.
Sure.
You're better off if you have great abstraction and layering and at the runtime you have garbage collection and things like that. You're actually better off in a compiler scenario as well, especially if what you're building is an interactive compiler that will incrementally react to typing in an IDE or something like that.
Absolutely.
You really can't rely on the old compiler, very concrete data structure oriented compiler patterns anymore.
Sure. I mean, the IDE is essentially a big container of compilers.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a big part
of it.
Front
end, back end, you have database that stores all the information. Yeah. All right, we got a question from Al. Right on, Al. It's always good to see you on Channel 9, my friend. Are the graphics debugging tools available for desktop apps as well?
I have no idea.
Now, our good dear friend Al apparently is on some sort of crusade about, you know, why isn't the desktop the same thing as, you know, the modern desktop or the modern shell or the thing that, you know, WinRT, one way to think about it, the place where Windows Store apps run. Well, maybe you should come to Build, my friend, and, you know, we'll talk about that stuff. But right now we have Mads Torgersen on, and we're talking about C#.
And there's one for me.
Hey, R. Keith Hill. Thank you, man. So don't most UI async scenarios still get complicated in the face of the user closing the associated UI before completion?
Yes, there's still, I mean, I make it sound like you just sprinkle in these keywords and everything's like in the good old days. Mm-hmm. That's not entirely true. Asynchrony in itself inherently is, comes with some extra complexity. We make it easy for you to write asynchronous code, but you still have to deal with the fact that it is asynchronous. So let me explain what I mean by that. I mean, a good phrasing is one my colleague Alex Turner often uses: with great responsiveness comes great responsibility. I love that line. so you go async in order to become responsive. Typically, it's on a UI thread. You can do it in many other situations too. Backends will benefit from this as well. But let's just take the UI scenario. Mm-hmm. You want the UI to listen to you while it's getting something off the web or whatever, okay? So you want it to be active and not blocked. Great. But when it's blocked, it means the user can do stuff. Okay, the user can, and now is actually able to press that cancel button or do a root cancel by closing the window and stuff like that. Mm. And so you do need to be aware of this and code for this. You do need to handle what happens if the code is not around to deal with the response once it comes back, and so on. So therefore, we have a pretty, I think, an awesomely well-designed, if I can say so, I didn't design it, infrastructure for cancellation, for instance.
Okay.
So you have these cancellation tokens that signal cancellation. one thing you can have going when you have an asynchronous piece of code is that many parts of your code can be active at the same time. Mm. All but one are parked at an await, you know, waiting for something else to happen, and one is currently running. Mm-hmm. So when cancellation happens, all of these can get signaled. Depending on who started them, they can send down a thing called a cancellation token saying, this is how I'll tell you if you get canceled. And then you need to be a little bit responsible about receiving a cancellation token and doing the right things if you get canceled and so on, making sure you free up resources or print a nice message if you weren't expecting to get canceled here or something like that. But okay. There's infrastructure for that. And it is perfectly true. You didn't have to do that when your UI was just blocking up. It's sure. The one good thing you can say about a toilet bowl of death situation is that you don't get unexpected input from the user because you just ain't listening.
Absolutely. Excellent. Great question. Al, this is from Al. Maz, do you think Roslyn will ever be able to parse compiled assemblies? That would be great for reflector-like apps.
Oh, to parse compiled assemblies? So if the question is, will it be able to present a high-level model of the code that's in the assemblies as opposed to just the metadata? Mm. I can't rule that out in sometime in the future. That is not the goal of Roslyn, though. The sure. goal is to be a high-level representation of the source code, okay? It also represents stuff that's read in from metadata insofar as you need those types and members and so on to express what's going on in your source code. So your source code will depend on assemblies, but only on the metadata from those assemblies. Mm. So it is not our job to represent reflector-like, to represent IL essentially as some kind of structured thing.
Yes.
You could imagine some kind of Roslyn for IL or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that is not our goal, and that's not what we're heading for.
So you're at the source code, the front end source code level.
That
the
is
syntax,
true.
Not yes. the IL, which is the intermediate
yes.
compilation.
Which is also the reason why C# and VB have separate Roslyn stacks. Mm. And it's not, there's a bunch of shared code, like the metadata reader, for instance, is shared, obviously, because you read the same metadata regardless of whether you're the C# or VB compiler, but the representational layers for source code are different. They are designed together and they follow the same patterns, but they are different sets of types.
So now, speaking of RX, we have a question from Al, and I'm taking this out of my ear because it just doesn't work. At Mads, do you think we'll ever see language support for iObservable?
Do I think we'll ever see language support
for iObservable? Will we see RX baked into C#, man?
So that's a good question. You have push streams instead of pull streams, essentially. Just like you have, like, for each is a language feature that depends on iEnumerable,
yes.
Essentially, right?
Okay.
And query expressions do as well, essentially.
Okay.
Would we have a similar functionality for push streams like iObservable? Mm. I don't know for sure.
Okay.
I think we'll just have to see if the scenarios come up. I think what we've seen is that RX has found a really strong audience for certain scenarios. You have event streams that are real-time events coming in, and it's a real cool way of composing essentially the treatment, the pipeline for those events and
sure.
what happens with them. Like a cool scenario, one of my favorite scenarios for RX is Connect. Like you get skeletons. Hey, you have a stream of skeletons, right?
Yes. How,
you know, it's a bit morbid, but but there it is. You get one skeleton after another.
Yeah.
And structuring your app using RX around processing those skeletons to do something fancy with people's body posture. That's a great example where that architecture is just right.
Absolutely.
We're just, for the language itself, we just have to sort of, we have to wait for something to become sufficiently general purpose or broad spectrum in terms of audience for it to sort of deserve a language feature. We have to be really careful with a language with such a big audience and so many different kinds of uses that the things we choose to actually graphed into the language have broad usage.
Absolutely.
And it's not clear yet whether RX has that.
Sure. Now, in terms of, you know, this is the Visual Studio 2012 launch.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are a first-class language, obviously, in Visual Studio. You were invented for .NET in Visual Studio. Talk to me a little bit how this whole async thing, is it actually being used? Is async await actually being used in, say, the base class library implementations that exist today?
It is now, yeah.
Great.
I mean, there's a limit as to how many of the base class library implementations could use it, because most of them were written before the language feature was put in.
Of course, yeah.
But actually, you know, as I mentioned, there was an equally big push on the framework side to roll out modern asynchronous APIs. Mm. And a lot of those are written with the await feature.
Okay.
So they do feed on each other already. It's also important to note that the Windows runtime, the API and infrastructure underlying the new Windows is also heavily asynchronous and is using very similar patterns that we call in .NET, we call them tasks. They call them iasync info, so iasync operations. Mm-hmm. JavaScript calls them promises.
Okay.
But they're really the same kind of thing. These objects that represent ongoing stuff. And we can trade in those between those different worlds.
Mm.
It takes a little bit of, just a tiny bit of manual translation between the .NET and Windows world, mm-hmm. but we made that very smooth. And they expose totally seamlessly to JavaScript as well as promises.
Okay.
So the asynchronous world is not something that's just closed on .NET itself, but it's really part of, actually, part of the very fabric of the Windows runtime. Everything that's expected to potentially take more than, I think, 50 milliseconds, that's a mandate there. It has to be asynchronous so that you can be responsive while it's ongoing.
Absolutely. And as we did talk about, though, I think one of the things that's important, you sort of touched on it, is this notion of asynchronous design. We talk a lot about development and design of these modern apps, these Windows Store apps, these web pages, these things that consume stuff from the cloud, continuous services, etc. But I have seen examples of where you're designing asynchronous operations at the code level, you click on this button, something happens, but the user can still click on the button. Or you haven't let the user know that, hey, I'm doing stuff, chill out. I mean, I didn't block you, but don't go ahead and start freaking out all over the UI, even though you can. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some notion of asynchronous design that you build into these modern apps.
Yes. So that's sort of the front that, and really, that has always been the case, that you really ought to think about these things.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's just very much in your face, because the infrastructure more or less forces you to be asynchronous, whereas before you could always bail and go modal or, you know, gray out the UI or something like that. So now every time you have some operation going on that's user initiated and that probably will be asynchronous if it runs for any significant period of time, you have to think about, what about the rest of the UI? What about the things that the user will do in between? Should I disable some of those things?
Mm-hmm.
Like if I press compute, I probably want to disable that button itself until I'm done computing.
Yes.
So you have to remember to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the UI, can that somehow interfere with the stuff you're in the middle of doing as the asynchronous operation? You can have many, many asynchronous operations going on at the same time.
Mm.
Because they do take breaks at these await points.
Mm.
And so what you essentially see is the potential for strong interleaving of many different sequential flows, all on the UI thread, taking turns at every await point, scheduling themselves back on the UI thread whenever they're ready to do something new.
Mm.
And you have to think about, and there's no general way of doing this, but you have to think about in your specific domain, for your specific things, how will I deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
Will I let people go crazy? Is it fine for them to click all over the place? Mm-hmm. Do I do something in a UI to keep it down or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is not really, that's a challenge, but it's not a problem, because it's part and parcel with building a responsive app that feels live, feels useful, right? That it doesn't just go away until later.
Understood. I guess my point is sort of, we've gone so far, if you look at sort of the continuum of highly synchronous to like highly asynchronous, you know, there is sort of a middle ground where sometimes it's, you know, maybe sometimes it's okay to block, man.
Yeah.
Maybe it's okay to block the UI thread, depending upon what your app is. What if my app is a computationally intensive thing?
No.
You press on a button.
It's never okay to block
it's
the UI thread.
It's never okay. Let's
it's
talk about
it's never
that.
Okay
Why?
To block the UI thread.
Why never?
Why? Because it's not just about preventing user code from running or whatever. You're literally blocking the interaction itself mm-hmm. between the user and the machine, mm. like for that app, for that window. Mm-hmm. And that is just too big a hammer to ever use.
Understood.
So what if you have some compute intentional intensive stuff you want to do? Mm-hmm. You should do what we've sort of always recommended. You should offload it to another thread. Now, we just made that tremendously easy. With the async infrastructure, the task infrastructure, mm-hmm. it's super easy to do. You take the computation, you wrap it in a Lambda, you post it to the thread pool by saying task.run. That's all you need to do. You get back a task, you await it. Okay. So all I had to do was wrap this little thing around my compute-intensive piece of code, mm-hmm. and now I've offloaded it to another thread and made it easy to get the results or exceptions or whatever back on the UI thread. So I'm still waiting for it, but I'm keeping the UI thread live in the meantime.
Fair enough. Now, what if you have code that expects synchrony? So it expects to call something in a synchronous way. So right. do you understand what I'm saying? So the code is, so you have old code,
yeah.
and you're not going to change that old code. How do you get around that problem?
Well, so if the code expects nothing else to be running, mm-hmm. if it has that strong of an expectation, then, you know, all bets are off. You yeah. really can't, you can't both be responsive and run that code
yeah.
because it expects you to not be responsive. So that's okay. just, you got to draw a line in the sand there. But if all it is that it's code that can perfectly well run alongside other code, it's just that it wasn't written to be asynchronous. Well, mm. you can post it to a different thread. Okay. And that thread will run while your UI is running and mm. you just hope you don't get conflicts and you got to deal with that.
Sure.
Now, I talked before about how you can have many asynchronous flows going on at the same time on the same thread, and that sounds to people like, oh, I've got the whole locking nightmare, shared state, and all that. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as bad as multi-threading. Multi-threading, you've got to really think about something can change at every instant while I'm executing this code. But with asynchronous code, interleaving on a single thread is not that bad because the other code can only run when I'm at a point where I say await. I am awaiting something that isn't there yet. Well, that's a point where someone else can run. But elsewhere, I'm the only one on my thread. When I'm running, I'm the only one on my thread. So you only have these few points in your code where things can change. Mm. And if you manage what can change at those points, mm-hmm. or you reassert your expectations about the state of the world after each await, then you're pretty good.
Excellent. So we're here with Mads Torgersen. You should send questions to #CH9Live. I see some of you are also doing it to @CH9Live. Whatever, either one's fine. Ask questions. We got Mad, C sharp, VB, F sharp. Speaking of F sharp, which
oh, yeah.
we haven't talked about yet.
Yes.
How does, tell me about it. Like, what's sort of the trajectory of F sharp? Where are we today?
Right. So we've talked about C sharp and VB as being, you know, brothers that are almost, you know, joined at the hips.
Yes.
And F-sharp is very different from that. We've taken a very different approach to F-sharp where it's kind of cool for it to be different. Mm. It's actually part of its role in life is to be different. And many things that were in F-sharp first, including async to some degree, have later sort of shown up. The whole functional paradigm that shows up with lambdas and so on in
yeah.
C-sharp and VB, you know, that's the kind of thing that F-sharp is built on. And we continue to see things show up first in F-sharp. It's really, mm. in that sense, a front-runner language for us. And the direction we've taken with F-sharp this time around is to focus it very much on what we call data-rich applications, focusing it very much on dealing with big data.
Okay.
Data on the web, in the cloud. So here we have an example of features coming in from C-sharp and VB to F-sharp where we've enabled the link in F-sharp, mm. for instance, just to be on par with the other language when it comes to consuming data.
Okay.
But the really new and fancy feature in F-sharp that's totally, you know, mind-blowing and innovative and never seen before in the world of programming languages is called type providers.
Okay.
And it's totally awesome. And to explain what it really is if you think about the coding experience in C#, that's very type directed. You know, all the IntelliSense and tooling and checking is based on types. F# is that on steroids, right? It's super strongly typed. And you have a lot of weakly typed data out there, but that still has structure. You know, it's schematized data, but it's not in a way that is naturally understandable to a compiler or whatever.
Okay.
And what a type provider is a little plug-in to the F# compiler that you can write that will visit, you know, live as you're compiling or editing, will visit data, interpret its structure in terms of the F# type system, so that what out there is some kind of schema will get translated into .NET types.
Wow.
So that you can use IntelliSense, the dot, as you're editing your code, to navigate the data of the world, the structured data of the world.
Awesome.
You just need a type provider for it, and you can code against it directly. You don't need to auto-generate or maintain huge .NET mappings. So you can have these domains that have millions and millions of types in them, schematized data, that is only mapped on demand by the compiler as you consume it. And the coolest thing is that you don't even need to generate those types and have them stay around for runtime, because the type providers can then generate the weakly type code for you to go and access the code you would have had to write manually, unsafe code that you would have written wrong in the third of the cases.
Okay.
It generates correctly to go and actually access that data at runtime. So it's a huge, huge help in consuming all those gobs and gobs of data that are now becoming services all over the place.
Absolutely.
And I think this is a mindset that's just mind-boggling, plugging yourself into the actual development experience and getting live access to data and structure while you're coding, essentially across all the world's data, as long as there's a type provider for that kind of schema.
Excellent.
So I'm really excited to see what happens with that. I think people who take a bet on F# in this space will really get a leg up on the rest of us. And you know, I'm as a C# language designer, I'm really interested to follow it and see where that feature goes, because that's one that I think can, it sort of has that same smell, that async and await, that this could be something that could show up in many programming languages in the future. It has good export qualities, if you will.
Excellent. So that's good to know. So we may see, who knows, something like that in your languages.
That's possible, but I think for now, the main thing is that people should go and try it out in F# and actually experience the power there. And because it's there today, it's a fully supported language, and a whole lot of things just became a lot easier if you write your application in F#.
Now, because F# is essentially a first-class citizen in .NET, nothing's stopping you from writing an application that consumes, you write a custom class or write a custom type that basically wraps this type provider thing in F#, and you can access it from C#. Couldn't that work?
Possibly.
Possibly.
It's possible, actually, that with, ironically, by making our, well, not ironically, but we were talking about Roslyn before.
Yes.
And the more we open up the live developer experience in C#, BB, the more possible it becomes to plug yourself into it at design time. So I could, that's actually a really good idea. Maybe some third party, if we don't get to it, maybe some third party enthusiast could go and actually wire C# development to F# type providers.
Yes. Hey, there's a business opportunity for you, Al. Make some money, man. All right, so we only have a couple minutes. We have like about a minute left. Let's end the minute with, you know, you had some big problems to solve in this release. And you saw, I mean, you would say that you solved them.
Sure.
What are some of the things you're thinking about for the future in languages that exist?
In languages that exist.
Yeah, C#.
As opposed to making new ones.
Yes, exactly.
So I think it's very hazy right now, but it's clear that cloud is a big domain that we have to think more about. I think we know pretty well how to program a client, and we're figuring out how to there's a lot still to do, but we're figuring out how to deal with the interaction between a client and a service.
Okay.
How to code a service is fine as long as you can run on a single instance in Azure or something like that. Once it grows really big, though, once you have something that's big and complex, like big compute, I don't think we really know how to do that. Okay. How to do that well with our existing languages. And so that's an area where there might be stuff to discover. I just want to keep it open, though, and we're looking at the cloud, and we'll do a language feature when we need one. We don't feel like, oh, what do we have to come up, you know, what should we come up with this time? We've always waited for there to be a huge opportunity, a clear problem, and then some innovative mind coming up with an awesome solution, and then we roll it into the language. So that's what you're going to see next time as well.
Rock and roll. And you certainly did that with Async Await.
So, well, thanks.
With that said, thank you very much.
Thanks
and hey,
me.
Thank you for dressing like a developer, to go back to the Brian's commentary.
I didn't have to go through the same...
nice job.
The same gates that Brian had to go through. I mean, poor guy.
Right on. So hey, Jerry Higgins is coming up next. We're going to go native with C++, C++ AMP, and some other things. Stay tuned.